From the Voice of America in Washington, this is VOA Global. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson. On today's program, for the first time, a ruling coalition government is overseeing India-Kashmir. We have more coming up on Daybreak Asia. The former Maldives president remains in custody. Sarah Williams has more on China Focus. Michael Lippin explores the China-Malaysia relationship 1 year after the disappearance of a passenger jet. That on today's Asia political scene. In the American Cafe, President Obama and others are trying to preserve U.S. historic sites and ecologically important areas. An aging documentary filmmaker and his wife meet a dynamic young couple. In the movies, that is. David Byrd will tell us more on Now. We'll check business and sports as well. It's all coming your way today on this edition of VOA Global from the Voice of America. This is Daybreak Asia. Hello and welcome to our summary of Asia news and events for Monday, March 2nd. I'm Jim Stevenson. Among today's headlines, the BJP, India's ruling party, has come to power in a coalition government in Indian Kashmir. It's the first time the Hindu Nationalist Party will have a role in governing India's only Muslim-majority region. Anjana Pasricha has more from New Delhi.
The integrity of India.
After Mufti Muhammad Saeed of the People's Democratic Party took the oath as Kashmir's chief minister, Nirmal Singh from the Bharatiya Janata Party was sworn in as his deputy in Kashmir's winter capital, Jammu. Prime Minister Narendra Modi watched the ceremony, described as historic because his Hindu Nationalist Party will share power in the Muslim majority state for the first time. The BJP has never been a serious political player in Kashmir, which is claimed by both India and Pakistan, and where anti-India sentiment runs deep. The two parties negotiated for weeks to stitch an alliance after elections held in November threw up a fractured result. While the regional People's Democratic Party won in the Muslim-dominated Kashmir Valley, the BJP got huge support in the Hindu-dominated Jammu region. The two parties are ideologically far apart, but have bridged their differences and worked out a program that sets aside contentious issues. Chief Minister Saeed has called it the coming together of the North Pole and the South Pole. For the time being, the BJP has put on hold its long-standing demand that a special constitutional provision that gives Kashmir autonomy should be scrapped. Satish Misra with the Observer Research Foundation in New Delhi says the alliance could help in integrating Kashmir with the rest of the country.
The BJP, which had been an enigma for the state of Jammu and Kashmir, now BJP would try to woo the valley also. Naturally, BJP would like its influence to grow in the valley also.
Some analysts say the BJP's participation in the Kashmir government could clear the way for talks with Kashmiri separatists, with whom Prime Minister Modi's government has refused to hold a dialogue. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
The Philippines is expressing serious concern over newly released satellite images that show major progress in China's reclamation work at contested outcroppings in the South China Sea. From Manila, we hear more from Simone Orendine.
The latest images published by IHS Jane's Defense Weekly show a large facility in the works at Johnson South Reef. In May last year, the Philippine military reported a Chinese construction ship was moving sand and rocks to augment the reef. The latest images also show from the start of construction at Gavin Reefs last March through this January, what appears to be a helipad, an anti-aircraft tower. The report says the work at Gavin has almost identical footprints to the reclamation activities at nearby Hughes Reef, which is claimed by Vietnam. Philippine Foreign Affairs spokesman Charles Jose says the country is seriously concerned about China's reclamation work.
And we have noted the Chinese construction in these features plainly intended to change the character, the status and maritime entitlements of these features. We have strongly urged China to desist from the reclamation work that they're doing.
Manila has filed multiple protests with Beijing over China's reclamation work at several outcroppings the Philippines claims among the Spratly Islands. Jose says China's response to the last submitted Johnson South Reef protest was that it had indisputable sovereignty over the South China Sea's islands. This has been China's position regarding any of its actions on or around the disputed rocks and banks. Furthermore, China's foreign ministry has said the country has the right to engage in construction activities at its occupied islands. China, the Philippines, Vietnam, Brunei, Malaysia, and Taiwan all have claims in the heavily traveled, resource-rich sea. Simone Orendine for VOA News, Manila.
Bad publicity about martial law, backpacker killings, and police shakedowns of foreigners have harmed Thailand's reputation as a tourist magnet in past months. As VOA correspondent Steve Herman in Bangkok reports, the tourism industry for 2015 is trying to attract more upscale visitors, as well as package tourists from China, who just happen to be spending more per day than other nationalities.
From the hawkers on the Phuket beach to the managers in five-star Bangkok hotels, about 1 in 10 Thais holds a job related to tourism. The sector suffered last year amid political tension with long-term street protests in Bangkok that culminated with a military coup. Martial law remains in effect. That and publicity overseas about tourists being victims of serious crimes on resort islands, police shaking down foreigners in the capital, and taxi drivers overcharging fares have combined to give many potential tourists second thoughts about visiting. At Bangkok's Dusitani Hotel, a five-star establishment dating back to 1970, General Manager Sukanya Janchu says the tourism sector has always managed to quickly bounce back from crises brought about by natural disasters, political troubles, or economic downturns.
We challenged nearly all crises we have. We learn from that is one after the other. It's quite challenged, but we always able to manage it pretty well.
Known as the Land of Smiles, Thailand hopes to put a happy face on the sector again this year and greet 28 million visitors, which was the numerical goal last year. In 2014, the total number of actual visitors was 26 million. But the goal for 2015 is not just a numerical target. Varatorn Sirisatayawang, an analyst at the Kasikorn Research Center, says Thailand this year will try to move away from its image as a backpacker's haven.
We try to attract the more quality tourists more than quantity. We have a hotel like five-star up, and also the niche market, healthcare, spa, and things like that.
Sukanya Janchu, who is also the marketing and public relations chairperson for the Thai Hotels Association, says the transition up market is not going to be achieved quickly or easily.
To drive from mass one is quite a challenge, but I think it can be done. Maybe it takes longer time, but we have to start.
China is now the largest single source of visitors to Thailand. The Chinese are considered the best spenders per capita on a daily basis, but their growing influence is not without controversy. During this week's Chinese New Year period, with 90,000 visitors from China expected, many are receiving etiquette guides. The brochures explain how to behave in museums and at temples, encourage proper rules for driving, and warn against public property as toilets. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
I'm Jim Stevenson. Daybreak Asia is a weekday feature of VOA. Stop by voanews.com for longer versions of these stories. And while you're there, subscribe to our free Daybreak Asia podcast. Time for your feedback, what you've been telling us about our stories from Facebook, Twitter, Weibo, and on our website at voanews.com. One of the stories that we've posted that you just heard on Daybreak Asia, India's ruling BJP has come to power in a coalition government in Indian Kashmir. It's the first time the Hindu Nationalist Party will have a role in governing India's only Muslim-majority region. Aaron from Chicago wrote to us, "What's wrong with you people? You look at the world with a religious glass all the time. What's the stuff about Hindu nationalists? Should we call the GOP as a Christian nationalist?" Another story that we had, demonstrators and police in Nepal's capital clashed Saturday as 30,000 opposition supporters gathered to protest the government's plan to have parliament vote on a new constitution. From Kathmandu, one of our listeners writes, 30,000. That accounts for a little over 1% of the entire population of Nepal, which was 2.78 million as of 2013. In statistical terms, at least, if not otherwise, that's insignificant in my opinion. Yes, 30,000 is a lot of people, but I, along with a lot of news readers, would find it helpful if you also put that into perspective of the entire population of Nepal. He does say thank you. In India, the government says it will focus on infrastructure development and on boosting investment as it proposes a slew of measures to propel the economy on a higher growth path. Dr. Joyce Banda from Kenya writes, India should work on progressive village empowerment to get good growth. Well, we invite the growth of all of your comments. You can write to us, as we mentioned, on Facebook, Twitter, Weibo. You can email your comments as well. We welcome them at voaasia@voanews.com. The former president of the Maldives remains in detention. Sarah Williams is just minutes away from telling us more about it on her segment, China Focus. But first, it's been almost 1 year since Malaysian Airlines flight MH370 vanished without a trace and 239 people on board, about two-thirds of them were Chinese. What's the impact of the event on the China-Malaysia relationship? We'll hear more from Michael Lippin next on Asia Political Scene.
I'm Michael Lippin with your weekly look at the Asian political scene. It's been almost 1 year since Malaysian Airlines flight MH370 disappeared on March 8, 2014, en route from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing with 239 people on board. About two-thirds of them were Chinese, making it a particularly painful tragedy for China, which for almost 2 months engaged in a bitter war of words with Malaysia about the chaotic aftermath. Chinese tourism to Malaysia dropped significantly in that period, straining the two countries' long-running friendship. Vikram Nehru is the head of Southeast Asian Studies at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. I asked him whether the MH370 disaster has done any lasting harm to Malaysian-Chinese relations.
There was a very short-term impact. In 2014, there was a slowdown in the number of tourists from China to Malaysia, and that was because of the MH370 incident, which caused some rough patches in relations between Malaysia and China. But that's been overcome, and now, Malaysia has introduced a new visa policy vis-a-vis Chinese visitors, and I think they're expecting a sharp increase in the number of Chinese visitors to Malaysia in 2015. The problems between Malaysia and China really only lasted for 2 months after the disappearance of MH370 on March the 8th, which is almost exactly a year ago. And by early May, it became very clear that China and Malaysia were very keen to, once again restore relations. And when Najib visited Beijing in end May 2014, Beijing welcomed Najib with open arms. There were new agreements made, economic agreements of various kinds. There was new forum for investment that was inaugurated, and it became very clear that both sides wanted to put the MH370 disaster behind them and move on.
Well, regarding that change in tone, which you correctly said happened around May last year, initially in that first month following the disappearance of the plane, Chinese state media were quite angry at Malaysia, but the tone did change during that visit that Prime Minister Najib made to China in the end of May 2014. So what do you think prompted China to tone down its criticism of Malaysia back then?
Well, you're very right that immediately after following the disappearance of MH370, there were several very stinging criticisms that came from China. Initially, of course, from the families that were affected, and that was understandable. There was a lot of concern about the way, Malaysia Airlines and the Malaysian government provided information in the early days. And this was followed by very strong words from senior Chinese officials, which also led to a reaction on the Malaysian side, who were rather taken aback by this very tough rhetoric that came out of China. But there was a big contrast between how the Chinese reacted to this particular incident and the way the Americans did. President Obama was much more supportive. He provided a lot of assistance in the search for MH370, even though there were very few Americans that were on board. His language was very encouraging. And then when he came to Malaysia, the first president after many decades to go to Malaysia in April 2014, he was very warmly welcomed by the Malaysians. And I think this was in such sharp contrast to the interaction between Malaysians and the Chinese that the Chinese couldn't have but noticed. I mean, they must have noticed this. And I think almost immediately afterward, literally starting on May the 1st, statements began coming from senior Chinese officials, which had a very different tone to the tone that they had used in days previous. So I think the Obama visit and the American support of Malaysia during its hours and days of need provided a very useful sort of counterpoint to the Chinese reaction, and I think did help in the Chinese toning down their rhetoric towards Malaysia.
That was Vikram Nehru of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace speaking from Bethesda, Maryland. Next week, I ask him why China would want to stay on good terms with Malaysia. I'm Michael Lippin.
I'm Sarah Williams with China Focus. Former Maldives President Mohamed Nasheed remains in custody after being arrested on terrorism charges related to his arrest of a judge while in power in 2012. The case has drawn the interest of the United States and India. The government of President Abdullah Yameen insists the arrest was in accordance with the law and remains an internal matter. India and the U.S. have taken a greater interest in Asia's smallest nation of nearly 1,200 coral islands, with a population of less than 400,000, since China's President Xi Jinping visited last September, and amid reports it has become a recruiting ground for jihadists. Rajiv Biswas, chief economist at IHS Global Insight in Singapore, tells VOA's Victor Beatty, Mr. Nasheed, the first democratically elected leader of the country, has been the object of legal challenges since he was forced to resign the presidency in February 2012.
He stated on the day he was ousted that it was actually, in his view, a coup because he was threatened by police and armed forces who had guns and had threatened him. So he's basically been subjected to a considerable amount of pressure to keep him on the back foot, I guess. And I think the background at the moment is also that there's concerns about the rising Islamization of the Maldives, and also that journalists are reporting that they're being threatened by various groups, even some allegations that ISIS are operating there and threatening people, or that the government is using that as a camouflage for threatening various journalists who are critical of what's happening in terms of the Islamization of the country.
India's taken an interest in this story. In fact, Prime Minister Narendra Modi is expected to visit the capital, Mali, in mid-March.
This is a country in South Asia, so India is extremely interested in developments in the region, and particularly if there's concerns about the Islamization of the Maldives, then it's also a security issue for India. I think from India's perspective, and also from the perspective of other countries such as the U.S. and also the U.K., the concern is that there should be a fair legal process and that the former president shouldn't be dealt with in this way, being manhandled by the police and you know, protect what seems to be subjected to police brutality. Having said that, Chinese tourism has been growing very rapidly in the Maldives, and China may also take an interest in, you know, having a greater economic role in the Maldives. So there's a added twist to the situation that makes it even more complicated, because it could be that pressure from the West and from India on the Maldives government could make them turn more towards China.
China's President Xi Jinping visited the archipelago just last year. Is there a strategic interest in the Maldives between India and China?
Certainly from India's point of view, it wants to maintain its maritime security, and it sees itself as a naval power in the Indian Ocean to secure India's coastline. From China's point of view, it's also clear that its own navy is becoming more focused on a greater reach internationally. So far, that's mainly reflected in the South China Sea and East China Sea. But there has been greater naval activity also by China in trying to support international operations in against piracy against in the Indian Ocean as well. So I think we are seeing that China is taking a more strategic global view of its naval role, and so it's possible that it could see that the Maldives plays a role in that overall picture, particularly because recently Sri Lanka had a change of president, and Sri Lanka had been very much working with China, including the development of major ports. And there had been Chinese naval ships visiting Sri Lanka, but the new president in Sri Lanka has very decisively shifted direction towards the West and towards India. So China may be, you know, looking also for some realignment of its own positioning in the Indian Ocean region.
Rajiv Biswas, chief economist at IHS Global Insight in Singapore. Follow us on Weibo. That's China Focus. I'm Sarah Williams.
From the Voice of America in Washington, this is Asia Business News. I'm Jim Stevenson. An index that measures China's manufacturing activity went up slightly in February, but still showed contraction amid China's economic slowdown, according to official data that was released on Sunday. The latest monthly purchasing managers index went up to just under 50 from January's 9.8. China Federation of Logistics of Purchasing reported the index is on a 100-point scale, which shows that numbers below 50 of activity are contracting. February's reading meant activity contracted from the previous month. The gauge dropped below 50 in January for the first time since October 2012. Last month's reading of 49.9 is the second consecutive reading showing contraction and signals downward pressure on the Chinese economy. Samsung has unveiled a stylish new flagship phone that ditches its signature plastic design for more stylish metal and glass. The South Korean phone manufacturer also unveiled a premium model with a display that curves around the left and right edges so that information can be quickly glanced at on the side. The Galaxy S6 and S6 Edge will both include technology for mobile payments, although Samsung is not unveiling a service to rival the iPhone's Apple Pay until later in the year. Iraq's oil minister Adel Abdel Mehdi said Sunday world oil prices were gradually rebounding, and he expects to see a barrel of crude oil selling at around $65. Global benchmark Brent crude closed on Friday at $62.58 a barrel after falling as low as $45.19 in January. That was less than half of its price in the middle of last year. OPEC producer Iraq has been hit by the slump, with revenues falling sharply as it faces a costly military campaign against Islamic State. That's Asia Business News.
This is Today in History. On March 2nd, 1836, the Republic of Texas declared its independence from Mexico. That date also was the 43rd birthday of Sam Houston, who was the first president of Texas. In 1882, Queen Victoria narrowly escaped an assassination attempt. On this day in 1901, the United States Congress passed the Platt Amendment. That limited the autonomy of Cuba as a condition for the withdrawal of American troops from the island. The man who was perhaps the 20th century's most famous author for children was born on this day in 1904. Theodore Geisel introduced us to such famous characters as the Cat in the Hat and the Grinch who stole Christmas. We better remember Theodore Geisel by his pen name, Dr. Seuss. In 1917, the Russian Revolution was set into motion with the abdication of the last Tsar, Nicholas II. On this day in 1933, the classic movie about the giant ape known as King Kong had its premiere in New York City. In 1946, Ho Chi Minh was elected president of Vietnam. In 1956, Morocco gained its independence from France. In 1959, Miles Davis held the first of two recording sessions that resulted in the album Kind of Blue. In 1962, an army led by General Ne Win seized power in Burma. Also on this day in 1962, Philadelphia Warriors center Wilt Chamberlain scored 100 points in a basketball game against the New York Knicks. That game was played in Hershey, Pennsylvania, where only 4,000 turned out to see the greatest individual scoring performance in NBA history. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. Coming up, Washington braces for a contentious visit and speech by Israel's prime minister. Tens of thousands of Russians march in tribute to a murdered opposition leader. And we'll have a report from a key Ukrainian port city under threat of attack from pro-Russian rebels. I'm Michael Lippin. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is arriving here in Washington on Sunday evening on a controversial mission to try to stop the United States from reaching what he calls a bad nuclear deal with Iran. Mr. Netanyahu is due to address the pro-Israel lobbying group AIPAC on Monday and a joint meeting of Congress on Tuesday. Mr. Netanyahu fears that President Barack Obama is willing to reach a deal with Iran that would enable it to develop nuclear weapons in the future. Iran has frequently called for the demise of Israel as a Jewish state, although Iranian leaders insist they do not want nuclear weapons. Mr. Netanyahu is expected to directly challenge Mr. Obama's strategy in the congressional speech, to which he was invited by Republican House Speaker John Boehner, also a strong critic of the president's Iran policy. The White House has strongly criticized the speech as a breach of protocol because it was not consulted before Boehner issued that invitation to Mr. Netanyahu. VOA's Michael Bowman has more.
Prime Minister Netanyahu insists he respects President Barack Obama, but adds,
"It is my obligation to see to the security of Israel. Therefore, we strongly oppose the agreement being formulated with Iran and the major powers, which would endanger our very existence."
Vice President Joe Biden and several Democratic lawmakers will not attend Mr. Netanyahu's address Tuesday, and the Prime Minister's itinerary does not include a visit to the White House. Even so, Secretary of State John Kerry is downplaying any lasting damage to U.S.-Israeli relations.
The Prime Minister is welcome in the United States at any time. We have an unparalleled close security relationship with Israel.
But whatever case the Prime Minister makes, it will not shake the Obama administration's belief that negotiations with Iran are worth pursuing. Michael Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
An Iraqi coalition of government troops and militias have begun a highly publicized offensive to push Islamic State militants out of the city of Tikrit. Iraqi Prime Minister and Commander-in-Chief Haider al-Abadi announced the start of the operation on Sunday as he traveled to nearby Samarra to oversee efforts to liberate Tikrit and the surrounding governorate of Saladin. Thousands of Iraqi Shiite militiamen, local tribes, and Iraqi forces are said to have teamed up to battle for the city. Tikrit has been under Islamic State control since mid-2014. A Syria watchdog group says 21 Assyrian Christians, elderly men and women, abducted by the Islamic State, have been released. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, which maintains a network of sources throughout Syria, says some of the kidnapped residents of Tal Quran were freed on Sunday. Local militias say at least 150 people were taken when Islamic State militants attacked Assyrian Christian villages along the Khabur River in northeastern Syria last week, overrunning several predominantly Christian towns. Well, three British teenage girls suspected of traveling to Syria to join the Islamic State group have appeared on a surveillance video in Turkey. Turkish media say the images that were recorded in mid-February show the teens boarding a bus in Istanbul. It's the first reported sighting of the girls since they left London almost 2 weeks ago. Authorities have said they have no reason to believe that the girls are still in Turkey and believe they have crossed into neighboring Syria, parts of which are under control of the Islamic State.
Tens of thousands of Russians have marched in central Moscow to mourn the murder of opposition leader Boris Nemtsov. Many of those who joined Sunday's march carried Russian flags and placards saying, "I am not afraid." The 55-year-old Nemtsov was shot dead on Friday night on a bridge near the Kremlin while he was walking home from a restaurant. He was a veteran liberal politician and a vocal critic of Russian President Vladimir Putin. Organizers said 70,000 people joined the march, while Moscow police gave a smaller estimate of 21,000. Former Russian Prime Minister Mikhail Kazyanov, another critic of Mr. Putin, said he thinks the Nemtsov killing will have a major impact on the country.
This tragic event, which happened 2 days ago, is absolutely a turning point for the whole history of New Russia. People would start reconsidering everything that was going on in our country.
Well, President Putin has denounced the murder of Nemtsov as a provocation. The Kremlin says he is personally overseeing the investigation. In eastern Ukraine's port city of Mariupol, government soldiers say they fear separatists loyal to Russian President Putin are preparing to attack them. VOA's Patrick Wells spoke to those Ukrainian troops in Mariupol and has this report.
On the hills overlooking the Sea of Azov, soldiers of the Ukrainian army are digging in. These trenches, bunkers and fighting positions are part of a network of defences around Mariupol, a city which many fear is the next target in eastern Ukraine's pro-Russian rebellion. Despite a ceasefire which began on February 15th, soldiers here are expecting the worst.
I do not believe in the ceasefire because no one is obeying the rules of the Minsk negotiations. The level of shelling has gone down, but the fighting continues. That is why I think an attack is coming. If it continues like this, it is going to happen.
Without either capturing or encircling this city, pro-Russian forces won't have a land bridge to recently annexed Crimea, the strategically vital peninsula which gives the Russian Navy access to the Mediterranean. The rebels have already claimed Mariupol as their own, but Ukrainian forces say they won't leave without a fight. With so much still to gain for both sides in this conflict, the ceasefire seems little more than an opportunity to regroup before the weather improves. Patrick Wells, for VOA News, Mariupol, Ukraine.
And before we go, two American astronauts at the International Space Station have sped through a spacewalk in 2 hours, completing the third such mission in just more than a week. The U.S. Space Agency says Terry Virts and Butch Wilmore finished routing 244 meters of power and data lines needed to allow the next generation of spacecraft to dock with the space station. After the spacewalk, Virts said a small amount of water had seeped into his helmet, as it had after a spacewalk last week. But he said it was no big deal. NASA has given contracts to Boeing and SpaceX to develop spacecraft capable of transporting astronauts to the space station by 2017. Well, that's a roundup of the latest world news on International Edition. Join us again at 0330 Universal Time for another look at the latest world news. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington.
This is Business News on the Voice of America. I'm Jim Stevenson. It's big business at the movie box office, where Will Smith's con man caper Focus dethroned 50 Shades of Grey. The film's modest $19.1 million opening still left some questions about the drawing power about the once unstoppable star. According to studio estimates Sunday, Warner Brothers' Focus easily topped all competitors on a weekend with little competition at North American multiplexes. In second place was the Colin Firth spy thriller Kingsman: The Secret Service, which made $11.8 million in its third week of release. After 2 weeks at the top of the box office, 50 Shades of Grey continued a steep slide, landing in fourth, not too bad though, an estimated $10.9 million for Universal Pictures. 50 Shades, which has made $486.2 million globally, fell behind Paramount's SpongeBob movie, Sponge Out of Water, which earned $11.2 million in its fourth week. Germany's finance minister said Sunday that he trusts Greece's current government to fulfill the conditions for the bailout deal that was recently made, but also made clear the country would not receive any further money if it didn't. The finance minister told the German newspaper Bild that he trusts them to implement the needed measures and to ultimately fulfill its obligations. Nokia, the world's third largest mobile equipment maker, has seen nothing in its business that would lead it to change its financial outlook, according to its chief executive on Sunday. Nothing specific has happened in the past couple of weeks, and it's kind of business as usual, according to CEO Rajeev Suri. According to Reuters, Suri reiterated previous comments that the Finnish company has made to stand benefits over the course of 2015 from a sharp drop in the value of the euro against the U.S. dollar. It's a brief look at business news on The Voice of America. This is our first VOA Global since we learned of the death of actor Leonard Nimoy, and we wanted to acknowledge that. Immortalized as the half-human, half-alien Mr. Spock on TV Star Trek, Nimoy died in Los Angeles Friday at the age of 83. He played in countless minor movie and television roles before he was cast as Mr. Spock in Star Trek's 1966 debut. It only lasted 3 years on TV, but it's become immortal for a lot of us.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. President Obama, along with others, are trying to preserve U.S. historic sites and ecologically important areas so the lessons of the past can inform future generations. With this in mind, he recently designated a World War II Japanese-American internment camp in Hawaii and the 8,500-hectare Browns Canyon site along the Arkansas River in Colorado as national monuments. This designation brings some legal protections that will also help the Pullman Historic District in the city of Chicago. VOA's Caden Faribault was there.
These grand Victorian red brick buildings once housed the machinery and people that were the beating heart of the Pullman Palace Car Company in the late 1800s and early 1900s. In its heyday, Pullman was the premier manufacturer of luxury rail cars. The Pullman Company became one of the largest employers of African Americans, who worked as porters and staff on Pullman sleeper cars. Among those porters was an ancestor to someone close to President Barack Obama.
One of those porters' great-granddaughter had the chance to go to a great college and a great law school and had the chance to work for the mayor and had the chance to climb the ladder of success and serve as a leader in some of our city's most important institutions. And I know that because today she's the First Lady of the United States of America, Michelle Obama.
President Obama said his wife's ancestors also helped organize the first African-American labor union. U.S. Congresswoman Robin Kelly encouraged the president to make Pullman a national monument.
He worked in this area when he was a community organizer, he knows, and I think this will be a part of his legacy.
Making the neighborhood a national monument will help preservation efforts and encourage people to visit the site to understand its role in shaping America. Caden Faribault, VOA News, Chicago, Illinois.
Billions of dollars are spent each year trying to clean up litter carelessly thrown on city streets and highways. About half of that garbage is discarded food. As VOA's Roseanne Skirbo reports, a new study shows how tiny ants can help clean up the mess.
Ants do important work in cities, although you would never know it, from the 1998 animated film Ants. In this clip, Woody Allen plays Z, an unhappy city ant.
All my life, I lived and worked in a big city, which, now that I think of it, is kind of a problem, since I always feel uncomfortable around crowds.
Z might feel trapped, but real city ants do not. They eat garbage. And there's a lot of edible garbage in cities, says North Carolina State University insect ecologist Elsa Youngstead, lead author of the study in the journal Global Change Biology. The researchers conducted a controlled experiment in New York City parks and on the grassy street medians along 150 blocks. At each site, they laid out two tempting banquets of common junk food, hot dogs, potato chips, and cookies. Youngstead expected that the park ants would consume more food than their cousins who live next to the street.
But we found the opposite, where in medians, about 2 to 3 times more food got eaten by the arthropods than it did in parks. And it looks like it's most likely this one species of ants called pavement ants that were doing a lot of the eating. the ants and arthropods that live there could probably clean up more than a ton of food per year, or something about like 60,000 hot dogs or a couple hundred thousand cookies.
The experiment also showed that ants and other insects are competing for the same food as rats and pigeons, and that helps limit the population of those urban pests. Youngstead says that points to the importance of maintaining a variety of green spaces in urban areas. She adds, the garbage-eating insects are tough bugs. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
The ants go marching one by one. Hurrah, hurrah.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. You are invited every day at voanews.com and on many podcast platforms.
Hi, everyone. I'm David Byrd, and here's what's happening now. Comedian and actor Ben Stiller and acclaimed director Noah Baumbach combine on a new film, While We Were Young, about an aging documentary filmmaker and his wife who meet a dynamic young couple. Stiller plays Josh Shrebnick, a New York-based documentarian who never quite succeeded as much as he thought he would. He is 10 years into working on his magnum opus and has hit a creative logjam. Josh and his wife Cornelia, played by Naomi Watts, have tried to start a family and have not been able to. Josh, who is 44, is haunted by the feeling that something is missing. Adam Driver plays Jamie, a young and spontaneous artist who, along with his girlfriend Darby, played by Amanda Seyfried, are ready to drop the boring, everyday pursuits of life to go after whatever strikes their fancy. Eventually, Jamie and Darby's dreams collide with Josh's film to the point of involving Josh's celebrated filmmaker father-in-law, played by Charles Grodin. That sends Josh into a tailspin that culminates in a dramatic confrontation with Jamie. The film was written and directed by Noah Baumbach, who is best known for his autobiographical films Kicking and Screaming, and 2005's The Squid and the Whale, for which he was nominated for 3 Golden Globes and an Academy Award. While We Were Young premiered at this year's Toronto Film Festival, where Ben Stiller told the Associated Press that working with Baumbach made him bring out things that made him a better actor.
I mean, I feel, yeah, working with a director like Noah, he's interested in different things, not just the joke. He's interested in the character, and he's interested in the movie being what he sees in his head, which is something I don't quite understand, which I like. I like working with a director where you don't quite see it the same way as they do, but yet you come together on enough stuff.
Baumbach, who is known for his meticulous precision, once took 55 takes just to get a scene right. He's the son of film critics Georgia Brown and Jonathan Baumbach. Stiller, who also worked with Baumbach on 2010's Greenberg, says that Noah's attention to detail helps make his films extraordinary.
That's what's fun, is what, you know, just he'll do like 20 or 30 takes. And you go, why is he doing all these takes? And he never tells you why he's doing them, but, you know, he's waiting for something to happen or whatever it is. And it's fun to have, as an actor, it's fun to have that many chances and to explore it that much. It almost becomes like a play or something.
Naomi Watts plays Cornelia. She said that she was thrilled with the opportunity to work with both Ben Stiller and Noah Baumbach.
Both incredibly talented, very brainy people. The script, Noah's dialogue is really some of the best there is on screenplays. It just felt so truthful. And Ben underplays everything. He's such a funny but subtle actor. He's really great to work with. I learn a lot from both.
Adam Driver, who last worked with Baumbach on 2012's Francis Ha, says that he jumped at the chance to work with the writer-director again.
Sure, he just gets better, better and better. I just think that he is, one of the greatest directors that is alive, and we work with him on anything, to a Colgate commercial. I'd do it with him.
Amanda Seyfried plays Darby, as I mentioned, and she says that normally she's not really excited about walking the red carpet at film festivals. But she told the Associated Press in Toronto she was very excited about being there for this film.
Normally this red carpet stuff is like just such a thing to get through. I don't like to speak, and I always second guess what I say, but
I'm so excited because I haven't seen it. Normally I've seen my movie, so I'm just like going to do this. But now I'm doing this, and then I get to go like watch a movie that I did a year ago with Naomi.
While We Were Young also stars former Beastie Boy Adam Horowitz and Maria Ditzia. Is this another Baumbach autobiography? Well, it could be. The filmmaker just turned 45. So what do you think? Do you plan to see While We Were Young? Are you a fan of Ben Stiller? How about Naomi Watts? Well, let us know your thoughts by visiting our Facebook page, VOA Asia. And you can always email us your questions or comments by addressing them to voaasia@voanews.com. That's what's happening now. Until next time, I'm David Byrd.
Well, residents in Boston may just decide to stay inside and take in a movie. The record-breaking month of February may be over for the eastern U.S. city of Boston, but they're expecting more snow. A winter storm watch has been issued by the National Weather Service in anticipation of more of the white stuff. 102 inches falling on Boston so far. That's 2 meters of snow, just 5.6 inches or 14 centimeters away from the all-time record. It's sports time on the Voice of America. I'm Jim Stevenson. English golfer Andy Sullivan has won the Joburg Open in South Africa by 2 shots ahead of 5 players who finished at 2 under par, including fellow Englishmen David Howell and Anthony Wall. As Mark Tompkins reports from the course, perhaps the biggest prize for all three as a result of their finishing positions is a coveted place at the 144th Open Championship at St. Andrews, Scotland in July.
England's Andy Sullivan is the Joburg Open champion after a final round 66 left him on 17 under par and victory by 2 shots over a host of players on 15 under, headed up by the Irishman Kevin Phelan. Sullivan survived going in the water on the par 4 11th to recover with 2 birdies in his final 7 holes to clinch his second title in the city this year, having won the South African Open at the Glen Downer Golf Club just after Christmas.
It's a lovely feeling and I really enjoyed it. Me and Macca out there today, we had fun again, you know, me on that back nine. We just really enjoyed ourselves and felt like we played probably a bit better than we did yesterday and probably hit some really good shots down the stretch there as well.
The added bonus for Sullivan as well as winning is a place at this year's Open Championship at St Andrews in July. The other 2 places filled by fellow Englishman Anthony Wall and David Howell, who both finished tied second at 15 under par but qualified by virtue of their higher world ranking. It's Sullivan though that came out on top once again in Johannesburg, won 17 under par.
Mark Tompkins reporting. The International Olympic Committee said it would create a mourning area in the Olympic Village at next year's Rio de Janeiro Games where participants could remember family or friends during a moment of reflection at the closing ceremony. The remembrance area will remember all those who have lost their lives at the Olympic Games, Thomas Bach, the IOC's president, said at a news conference in Rio. Bach said that a solemn moment of reflection would recall events such as the deaths of 11 Israelis killed when Palestinian gunmen invaded the athletes' village at the 1972 Munich Games. Minnie Minoso, the seemingly ageless Cuban slugger who broke into the majors just 2 years after Jackie Robinson turned into the game's first black Latino star, has died. The Cook County Medical Examiner's Office did not immediately offer further details. There's some question about Minoso's age, but the Chicago White Sox say he was 90 years old, a star nonetheless. That's sports.
This is Science World Express. I am Rick Pantaleo. Dr. Ira Tabus, M.D., from Columbia University, along with colleagues there and Harvard University, have developed a unique new way to treat atherosclerosis, or hardening of the arteries, which could lead to a heart attack or stroke. He talks about the research that led to this new treatment method and how it could help those who suffer from the cardiovascular disease.
Can you give us a bit of an overview about these nano drones and this new treatment method?
I think the most important thing to understand about this advance is that it represents an integration of 2 new concepts. The first concept is using these targeted drones And the second concept is the drug that we loaded the drones with, which is a very special and novel type of drug. So with regard to these drones, and we call these nanoparticles because they're small spheres, the key properties of these nanoparticles is that they tend to go to areas of the vessels in our body that have these atherosclerotic plaques that cause heart disease. So these little tiny particles have been specifically designed by my colleagues at Brigham and Women, and it's very important to acknowledge Drs. Omid Farrakhzad and Nazila Kamali, because they were the brains behind designing these little nanoparticles that have a special property to find atherosclerotic lesions, and once they get there, to stay there.
How do these nano drones zero in on arterial plaque, and what do they do once they reach their target?
So there are three major properties that allow this to occur. The first property is they're coated in a way that makes it so that blood cells or other tissues in our body that would normally gobble them up and get them out of our body does not do that. And so the trick is to get these little nanoparticles to circulate in our bloodstream for as long as possible. The second property is that they are of a certain very small size and a certain charge such that they tend to go through areas of leaky blood vessels. And that is what characterizes these atherosclerotic lesions and distinguishes them from other places in our circulation. So these nanoparticles, because of their size and charge, tend to migrate to areas that have leaks in them. And then the third property is they were designed to have a little piece on them that recognizes something in the vessel wall. So once they leak through and get inside the vessel wall, they stick. And it's those three properties that favor their localization to these atherosclerotic plaques. So then the drones get inside the vessel wall, and then the drug that we package it with slowly leaks out of these particles. And then the drug that leaks out then can work on the various cells in the plaque, and then it promotes this healing process that is characteristic of these drugs. What we've known for a number of years now is that atherosclerosis, although initiated by the LDL or the cholesterol in our blood, after that initiation, that what drives the disease is inflammation. Now, inflammation is what all of us have to protect us against bacteria and viruses. But in the atherosclerotic lesion, this process gets out of hand. And in particular, whereas when we're fighting a bacteria or a virus, the inflammation is linked very directly to a healing process, which is meant to heal our body after the bacteria or virus are cleared, in atherosclerosis, this link is broken. So atherosclerosis has inflammation without the healing. And what these drugs do is promote the healing phase of this process.
Do you consider this treatment a cure?
It's not a cure. What it does have the potential for doing is that we can identify people that are at very high risk for heart attacks. And we know what we can do for these people in terms of long-term prevention. But for a period of 2 to 3 to 4 years, these people are still at very, very high risk. What I think this type of therapy could do in that large population of people at very high risk is lower their risk for heart disease during this vulnerable period.
That was Dr. Ira Tabus, MD, a researcher and professor at Columbia University in New York. Thanks for listening to Science World Express. Please visit us on the internet at voanews.com/science.
If you happened to be on social media last week, you probably saw a photo of a certain dress, and you were asked to figure out what color the dress was. It was a raging debate dividing families, friends, and work colleagues. A photograph of the two-toned outfit made by British retailer Roman Originals was originally posted on Tumblr on Wednesday by a user who said her friends couldn't agree on its colors. Some said they saw it as golden white, and others insisted it was black and blue, and since then the debate and disagreement has gone global. Well, scientists say that our brain uses three coordinates of the primary colors of light, red, green, and blue, to determine exactly what colors are out there. But because our retinal sensors and brains are slightly different from person to person, the perception of color can vary. This dress is an especially striking example of that phenomenon because its colors are not close to pure red, pure green, pure blue. Instead, they're a complex mixture of all those colors, and for that reason, there's no clear-cut or dominant response from the red, green, and blue receptors in the retina, according to scientists. What happens instead is a complex combination of responses which is interpreted differently by different individuals. So I guess we can all look at the dress and agree to disagree. By the way, I saw an interview with the dressmaker who said it was definitely royal blue and black. All right, that settles it. Our colors are red, white, and blue with the Voice of America, and we thank you for joining us today on VOA Global. Our director is Tracy Carter. Engineers were Daryl Smith and Carl Starling, and our managing editor, Diane Gao. I'm Jim Stevenson. We hope to join you again tomorrow for another edition of VOA Global.